Hello, and welcome to More or Less on the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Harford. In this week's programme, we'll be dipping our toes into the UK's election. But first... In last week's edition of that long-running BBC radio show, Desert Island Discs, author Isabella Tree made a claim about the versatile and delicious red berry of the plant Solanum lycopersicum.
You have to eat 10 tomatoes to get the nutrition out of one tomato in the 1950s.
Some loyal listeners wrote in to moreorless@bbc.co.uk to ask us about this.
Is this correct? Is it comparing like with like?
Which nutrients does it cover? And does it matter?
To help us find out if this is true, we turn to Paul Finglas from the Quadram Institute, a British research centre devoted to food and health.
Back in 1950, there would have been a very different type of tomato that was available to the consumer.
And was it 10 times better?
No, nutritious? Not at all. It's very hard to compare a tomato in 1950 with one in 2019. You know, for every nutrient that has gone down, there's probably a nutrient that's gone the other way.
And do you have any idea where Isabella Tree might have got that idea from?
I really don't. I went back and looked at the 2017 publication in the Journal of Food Composition Analysis, and they were talking now about a big reduction in copper values. It said that copper had gone from 0.1 down to 0.01 today. Whereas if you look at some of the data that we have now, we see that folic acid has gone from 5 to 22. And vitamin C, which is quite sensitive, has gone from 20 to 22. So in terms of changes, these numbers might look quite big, but nutritionally wise, they don't make much difference to what you're consuming from the diet.
Paul says the reason why tomatoes seem to have had so much more copper in the past might be down to the variety, but it might also be a measurement error.
The types of methods that were used in 1950 were quite crude in terms of how the copper was measured. So probably what would have been done is you take your sample, you put it into some solution, and then you react it with a compound that gives a colour, and then you measure the colour. Now, the problem with that, there's other things in the tomato that would interfere. So your actual number, it wouldn't be very accurate.
So it might simply be an artifact of the measurement method.
Exactly. Now, what we do today is we use things called ICP-MS, which is inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry, which is a very much more sophisticated technique.
That sounds like a pretty heavy thing to do to a tomato.
Well, yes, but you want to get to the most accurate value you have in your samples.
Is the tomato edible when you've finished with it?
Well, you wouldn't actually eat it after you've extracted it and done the tests.
OK. So it seems there are all kinds of sources of variation here. So there's the measurement technique used today versus the measurement technique used 60, 70 years ago. And the other thing, though, that struck me is when we talk about something being less nutritious or more nutritious, I mean, there are all kinds of nutrients and...
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
exactly.
There's vitamin C, there's copper. I didn't know copper was a nutrient, but I
yeah,
you know,
well, there's about in our food tables we have about, you know, 35 nutrients.
And it, presumably for some nutrients you only need so much, and then anything beyond that is unnecessary.
Exactly.
And other nutrients you can have too much of a good thing.
Exactly. So typically for copper, you would need about 1 milligram a day in order to meet your daily recommendations.
What's that in tomatoes?
It would be a lot of tomatoes. But in terms of copper-rich foods, like maybe cashew nuts, like for every 100 grams of cashew nuts, you have about 2 milligrams. So you would need to eat about 50 grams of cashew nuts a day. But there's a whole range of foods that would have copper in higher than tomatoes. So as part of your daily diet, as long as you eat your, you know, 4 or 5 portions of fruit, vegetables, legumes, you're going to be pretty much getting your daily requirement of copper.
Paul Finglas. I asked him which Christmas vegetable was the most nutritious. He would not be drawn on the subject. Britain's general election campaign continues. The parties have released their manifestos, their list of promises to voters of what they'll do should they get elected.
Hope. That is what this document is. A manifesto that will bring real change.
That's Labour's Jeremy Corbyn. His Conservative rival dismissed it.
None of this has any economic credibility whatever.
Well, we'll be the judges of that, Mr. Johnson. One thing that everybody seems to agree on is that Labour's manifesto promises a substantial increase in public spending, a big break with the past. So we wanted to get a sense of just how radical it really is. And to help us...
It's Chris Giles, I'm the economics editor of the Financial Times. Let's try and scale these numbers. What the Conservatives are essentially saying is the state will remain a very stable share of the economy, about 40%, and it will stay at about that level. What Labour's saying is it will move that share of the state in the economy from about 40 to about 46, so a 6 percentage point rise in the share of the state over 5 years. That is unprecedented in any period outside a war or a financial crisis.
Right, because it doesn't sound that big, 6 percentage points.
It's not a particularly big number. It's very standard European number for the amount of state spending in the economy, a little bit higher than Germany, but tiny. You know, it'd be very difficult to distinguish us from Germany or the Netherlands, lower than France, lower than some of the Scandinavian countries. So it is wrong to say this is turning us into, let's say, North Korea or something preposterous like that. It is a normal European level. What's different about it is the speed at which we're turning from being not a normal European country to being a normal European country. That's the proposal.
Labour have been at pains to say that most people won't be paying any extra taxes or nothing significant. Is that right? And if so, who is going to pay for this?
The vast majority of Labour's tax-raising proposals are essentially on corporate income of different sorts. So corporation tax, taxes on dividends, taxes on capital gains.
And I mean, that sounds quite attractive because I'm not a corporation. So that sounds like someone else is going to pay that.
Absolutely. That's in some ways the whole point, because it feels like someone else is paying. So it's some sort of faceless thing that's a company. They must have loads of money. But in the end, people pay, because only people can pay taxes. There are no such thing in terms of taxpayers that are companies, because companies in the end are owned by people. So in the end, people pay. So we have to decide who's going to pay. Who bears the burden is not the same as who writes the cheque.
In the end, do we have any confidence in where the tax burden would fall, whether it would ultimately end up falling mostly on shareholders or ultimately end up falling mostly on workers? Because I've had a look at some research on this topic and there's quite a wide range of estimates.
Your research is exactly the same as my research. It's very, very wide, and we shouldn't be confident about it either way.
Are corporation taxes and other taxes that target corporations, are they a particularly bad way to raise tax?
They're not a terrible way to raise tax at all. Most countries have a tax rate in total of about 3% of national income comes from corporate taxes. That's where the UK is a little bit higher than that, in fact. Germany and France actually have a little bit lower corporate tax burdens than the UK, though they have higher rates.
So, hang on a moment. So the UK raises more money from corporations and has lower rates. How does that work?
It's because we tax a wider part of companies' incomes. So in lots of other countries, investment, you don't pay any tax on that at all, and we're quite mean on investment. So we have what's known as a low tax rate, but a broad base. So we tax a lot of corporate income. France in particular has quite a high tax rate, 33%, and a very narrow tax base. It doesn't raise as much money.
In a nutshell then, Labour plan to raise quite a lot of money from taxes on corporations. Shareholders will end up paying some of that. Workers will end up paying some of that. And it's hard to be sure really what the divide will be between the two of them.
Yes, absolutely. And one thing you can say is also that the UK would tax corporate income very heavily compared with other countries. So we would move up to the top of the international table from being towards the middle of it.
Chris Giles, and that's all we have time for this week. Until next time, goodbye.